She glanced back behind her as one of the sharks began to edge a bit too near, and found Tavi staring at the leviathan in undisguised curiosity and glee. He saw her look back and glanced up at her. He pointed at the massive leviathan, and his grin widened still further, his smile so sharp and bright that she felt herself mirroring it. By contrast, Aaron, holding on behind Tavi, had his forehead pressed against the line with his eyes tightly shut. Isana could not help but feel that the young cursor had a perfectly serviceable amount of common sense. Tavi, after all, had a point. Certainly the business was dangerous, but they would have been in danger regardless of what they did. And how many people in Alera could claim to have seen something so utterly awe-inspiring as this? Septimus would have had exactly the same look on his face. Which, Isana realized, was important. It said something about him, as a man. His father had always counseled him to caution, to calculation, to committing all of his attention and focus to the task of ruling the realm. In one of the letters to his son that Isana had read, Gaius had called rule a practical matter of survival. Survival to the First Lord was all but indistinguishable from duty. Septimus had quietly, gently disputed the point with his father, but until now Isana had never truly understood the simple truth of what he meant. Survival was not the same thing as living. Septimus had gone into battle beside his men, despite the inexcusable risk to his person. He had traveled the realm in disguise, experiencing life outside of Alera Imperia. It was, in fact, upon one of those incognito jaunts that Isana had met him, when a furious cook had turned upon her little sister after she'd broken a plate, and Isana had smacked the woman hard on the cheek and pushed her away from Alia. Isana stood facing the angry cook until the woman muttered something and stormed away. Then Isana had helped Alia to her feet, and the two of them had walked away with at least a little dignity. A man she had never seen before came to her with a simple offer of work, and Isana had gladly taken it. Anywhere would have been an improvement over that scullery. She'd had no idea at the time that she and Alia had just become the maids to the senior officers of the Legion, Septimus's singulares, and to the Princeps himself. It was after that that they had begun to talk to one another, to fall in love, and to wed for love and not for political gain. Survival was not enough. One had to live. Septimus had never articulated it. He had simply lived it. Septimus had been fiercely determined to live, so much so that he had died for it. Living was a dangerous pastime, and often quite painful. But there was also such joy in living, such beauty, things that one would otherwise never see, never experience, never know. The risk of pain and loss was a part of living. It made everything else mean more. Beauty was more pure, more bright. Pleasure more full and complete. Laughter deeper, more satisfying. And contentment more perfect, more peaceful. She had, in a sense, betrayed Septimus in how she had treated Tavi after his father's death. She had been focused completely on protecting the boy, on forcing mere survival upon him. How much more would Tavi have seen and done and learned if she had chosen differently? How much different would her own life have been? In reducing Tavi's existence to a matter of survival, she had sheltered him from some pains, but exposed him to others and robbed him of what he might have had, and in doing so had robbed herself as well. The past was gone. Nothing could change what had already been. Looking back at it, letting its wounds fester, indulging in regret, was just a different, slower way to die. The living moved forward. Living. Isana felt the wild beating of her heart and realized that it did not race entirely and purely with fear. There was also a sense of elation there, of joy. She felt more alive there in that danger-filled murk than she had felt in all the years since Septimus had died. She would have to be a fool actually to enjoy this. She would have to be a liar to say that it didn't have its appeal as well. The pressure on her temples increased sharply and then suddenly faded. Isana was never sure precisely what happened, but they were suddenly streaking through the sea more swiftly than any shark, and Ril's presence swelled. Isana's senses expanded, exploded, becoming so intense that for a moment she thought that the whole of the ocean had suddenly turned as crystal clear as a cauldron spring. She felt the heavy, drowsy presence of the leviathans, 23 of them to be precise, and the endless, mindless swirling of the sharks, 300, give or take a dozen. She guided them past another leviathan's tail, noting the brightly coloured crustaceans crawling among the barnacles and scales, found the mactus beyond them and shot forward beneath the enemy vessel. They rose on the far side, and Isana made sure that they surfaced in total silence. The others laboured to keep their breaths quiet, but they nonetheless gasped for air after the long trip underwater. Isana kept pace with the Mactus, just outside of the watercrafting that concealed the presence of the ship from the sleeping leviathans. The Witchmen of the Mactus, Isana noted, maintained a far more slender watercrafting than the Witchmen of the Slive. Their work was no less complex, but there was much less of an allowance for the turbulence of the sea, probably because their ship was so much larger than the Slive, displacing much more water, and they had a considerably more difficult task in hiding it.
"Eren," Tarvi whispered hoarsely, "make us a hole."
Eren swallowed and kicked over to the ship. He released Isana's line and immediately sank one of his knives into the hull. He hung on, dragged through the water by the ship, put his free hand on the hull, and closed his eyes. Isana extended her senses toward the ship, and again felt surprised at the sheer clarity of what her crafting revealed. It was almost like when she performed a healing, sensing the pains and damage of a patient's body. She could feel the water all around the ship in contact with the hull, including a number of places where the patient, gentle force of water had found flaws in the hull and begun to slowly, steadily seep inward. She waited for a moment, but when Eren shook his head in frustration and slid his hand to the next board, she angled her course in closer.
"Lower, and about a foot toward the bow," she said quietly. "There's a leak there. They've patched it with tar and sailcloth, but the planks have begun to weaken."
Eren gave her a quick, surprised look. Then he moved his hand to the spot she'd suggested, and his eyes widened. He closed them, and his fingers stiffened, forming something like a claw. He shoved down forcefully, and his fingers sank half an inch into the wood. He made a satisfied growling sound and repeated the motion several more times, until his hand had sunk to the base of his fingers into the ship's hull. Then he took a deep breath, made a twisting motion of his arm, and pulled. There was a soggy-sounding crack, and the plank peeled away from its companions in the hull and snapped. Eren tossed a 2-foot length of board away, grasped the plank just below the new opening, and after another moment of concentration, snapped a second length of board away. Isana felt intense attention directed at her, and she turned to find Tarvi watching her, his green eyes narrowed. He leaned closer to her and murmured, "What happened?" She stared back at him for a moment, then shook her head.
"I'm not sure."
"Are you all right?"
"I'm..." She shook her head. "It's all one fury. All of it. The whole sea. If you can commune with any of it, you can speak to all of it. There's so much of it there, and I can't—"
She broke off suddenly as Tavi's hand covered her mouth.
"Shh," he said quietly. "You were raising your voice. Are you sure you're all right?"
Isana closed her mouth and nodded firmly.
"But hurry, we need to hurry. The sun is going down. I can feel them beginning to stir. We don't want to be in the water when they wake."
There was another crack, and Eren pulled himself up to the hole he'd created and thrust his head in. He leaned back a moment later, his nose wrinkling, and reported,
"Bilge, give me a moment to get through the other side."
Then the little cursor vanished into the hole. He reappeared shortly and nodded at Tarvi, then held out his hand. Isana felt the elation in her son at the intense experience of the adventure suddenly fade, and she felt it replaced with regret and steely determination.
He kicked through the water, seized the knife Aaron had left in the hull as a handhold, and with the cursor's help clambered inside. He had to go through the hole one arm at a time, his shoulders had grown so broad, and Isana was again struck by how very large the boy had grown. Kitai went next, though the Marat girl hardly seemed to need Aaron's outstretched hand to help her in. From Kitai, Isana could sense only what she almost always felt in her, a kind of detached feline amusement at the world around her, and an intense involvement in her senses and environment. Finally, Araris went, though he paused to glance back at Isana. She felt his worry for her very clearly.
"Oh, for goodness sake," Isana whispered, flipping a hand at him. "Go! I'll be safer than you'll be."
Araris frowned at her, hesitating. Isana felt the direction of his thoughts, the sudden irrational heat of them, and she felt her face heat up. "I like the way you look all wet as well," she told him, "but now is not the time." His eyes widened, and Araris gave her a sudden very boyish grin and a wink. Then he, too, swarmed up the side of the ship and threw the hole into the hull. Isana bit her lower lip and waited, pacing the ship. Her sharpened senses continued to flood her with their new-found clarity and depth, and it made what would otherwise have been a very simple process, remaining steady beside the ship, difficult to focus upon. The motion of the waves, the mindless and purposeful movement of the sharks, the swirling of the smaller fish feasting on what fell from the mouths of the sleeping leviathans, all blended together into something beautiful, almost hypnotic, like a vast dance being performed for no one but her. The sea around her stretched out, boundless and powerful, merciless and bountiful, and she could feel it all, to such a degree that for a few seconds she lost the feeling in her own limbs, their nerves and muscles vanishing among all the endless motion of the living sea. Fear and sudden agony hit her like a slap on the cheek. She had drifted ahead of the Mactus, and she hurried to return to her place. There was another stab of confusion and pain from somewhere in the ship. Great furies, she couldn't have felt that from here, not with such perfect clarity. She couldn't even see whoever had been hurt. Panic native to her own heart clutched at her. Had something happened to one of her own? The bond between loved ones, and especially family, had long been well established as a factor that enhanced a watercrafter's already acute empathic senses. And if Tavi or Araris had been injured, it might account for... The ship suddenly shuddered in the water. It wasn't a large motion, just a gentle bob, out of rhythm with the waves around it, as the watercrafting around the Mactus's hull abruptly failed. The next wave crashed against the bow of the ship with a roar like a miniature thunderstorm, and a great cloud of salt spray flew up from the impact. Isana felt a sudden surge of emotion from the Mactus. Disbelief gave way to panic and terror, and every single facet of emotion was blindingly intense. They slashed at her like razors, and she could hardly keep herself moving through the water. On the ship, men began shouting. Boots hammered on wooden decks. The nearest of the shouts weren't 20 feet away, up on the ship's deck above her. Isana fought to contain her agonized senses, to draw away from them, and as she did, she felt her pace suddenly slow, her progress through the water becoming noticeably more difficult. She gritted her teeth and left herself open to the painful flares of emotion and held pace beside the ship, though her teeth had begun to chatter in sheer nervous reaction to the fear. Another minute went by, and no one appeared at the hole in the ship's hull. There were more harsh shouts from inside the ship, and the ring of steel on steel. Then there was a hissing sound and a low howl of tortured wood toward the bow, where the witchmen were usually stationed. It repeated itself twice, and then Araris's bare foot kicked a triangular section of wooden hull away from the ship, its edges as clean-cut and smooth as if done with the finest saw. The severed planks fell into the sea. The Singulare looked out from the hole, spotted Isana, and waved a hand at her. Isana surged forward through the waves, just as Tavi appeared in the newly cut opening and tumbled into the sea gracelessly, as if he'd been pushed through.
Isana darted through the water and pressed one of the lines into his hand, then caught up to the ship again, just as Aaron leapt out and hit the ocean heels first. Kitai came next, diving through the hole, her arms extended, to enter the sea in a graceful dive. Isana rounded them up, made sure each of them had a solid hold on the line. It was getting increasingly difficult to concentrate, and Isana suddenly realized why. The leviathans had woken. The very water of the sea itself had all but begun to boil with a slow and monstrous anger. They had little time. Isana pressed as close to the newly cut hole as she dared. There was little point in stealth any more, and she called out, "Araris! Araris, hurry!" Steel rang on steel inside the ship. A man let out a cry of agony. "Araris!" Isana called.
"Crows, take it!"
Tavi snarled. "I was supposed to be the last off." A dim shape appeared in the opening, and steel clashed again. Isana saw an explosion of violet sparks raining against azure as the blades of two master metal crafters clashed, and then a sword's blade, scarlet with blood, plunged through the planks of the hull beside the opening. Araris appeared, weaponless, and stumbled sprawling from the hole in the hull to fall into the sea. The water around him immediately became stained with streamers of crimson. Isana stared at him, suddenly unable to focus, to think of the proper course of action. Panic upon the ship and rage within the sea pressed against her from both sides, a paralyzing weight. Tavi reached out and got one strong arm under one of Araris's. Moving as if in a choreographed performance, Kitai seized Araris's other arm so that he was suspended between them, his face just out of the water.
"Go!" Tavi shouted. "Go, go, go!"
Just then a sound surged up from the depths. Isana had never heard anything like it, so deep that it rattled her very bones, rising to a louder whistle or shriek that pressed against her eardrums like a handful of dull needles. The surface of the sea itself shook with it, sending up a fine cloud of spray that only rose a few inches above the waters. The sound hit her, and with it came a timeless, inhuman, unthinking rage, and the sheer volume, the emotional mass of it, left her arms and legs shaking with impotent terror. And then it happened again, from behind them, and again from ahead, and again, and again, and again, as the leviathans sensed the presence of intruders in their sea.
"Ah," Aaron panted, clearly terrified. "Ah, ah, that can't be good."
Isana felt the leviathans begin to move as they came alert, motions so vast that they made the ship seem like a child's toy bobbing on the surface of a mill pond. The other creatures of the sea swirled in frantic response, the smaller fish scattering, while the sharks became more restive and eager, moving in swifter and more erratic patterns. Isana felt it with terrifying clarity when several of them picked up the scent of Araris's blood in the sea and began slicing toward them. Men on the doomed ship began to scream. It was too much. Too painful. Isana knew she should have been doing something, acting, but the agony of all that motion, of all that emotion, had become a precise and inescapable torment that no amount of writhing could lessen. She clutched at her head and heard herself screaming through clenched teeth. Then a strong hand gripped her own, closing with power that barely avoided crushing bones, and Isana grasped at that pain as an anchor in the overwhelming fluid world that had overwhelmed her senses.
"Isana!" Tavi called. "Mother!"
That word from those lips came as a sudden shock, brighter and warmer and more terrible than all the others, and her eyes snapped open.
"Back to the Slive!" Tavi shouted. "Take us back to the ship! Hurry!"
"Aleran!" Kitai cried.
There was the sound of water being thrashed to foam, and then a shark arrowed by them, streaming a cloud of dark fluid behind it. Isana turned to see the Marat girl lift a bloodied dagger to her teeth and seize the unmoving Araris.
"The ship!" Tavi thundered, his voice ringing with command. "Kroos, take it! You are the First Lady of Alera, and you will return us to the ship!"
Her son's voice carried pure steel in it, iron control, and Asana grasped at that strength through the contact of their hands. Somehow it strengthened her, and she was able to push the overwhelming power being unleashed all around her from her thoughts. Reason returned in a cold, focused rush, just as another shark, the largest yet, made a run at the wounded Araris. Asana called to Ryl, sudden rage at the beast giving her strength, and the shark was flung from the water with violent force, arching into the air to land thrashing violently on the deck of the Mactus overhead.
"Hold tight," Asana growled.
She could feel the leviathans rushing toward them, the pressure wave of water that surged out ahead of them. The nearest had dived, sinking a mere 500 feet or so beneath them, and it was rising swiftly toward the ship, rising with nightmarish rage and power, and Asana could all but see what would happen to the ship when the ridge of scaled plates on its back struck the vessel's keel. She called to Ryl again, and they surged forward with such speed that the canvas harness bit into her skin even through the fabric of her clothing. They shot forward, skimming the surface of the water, and she could hear Eren's breathless shout of fear blending with Kitai's sudden whoop of excitement. They sailed forward, and Asana banked back toward the Slive. Their passage kicked up a curtain of water 10 feet high as they turned, barely avoiding the bulk of another leviathan cruising toward the Mactus. Asana called out to Ryl, to the sea, and as they flashed toward the Slive, the water rose beneath them, building up into a wave that lifted them from the surface of the already roiling ocean, so that as they reached the ship and the wave broke upon the water crafting around it, they simply washed up onto its deck. Deimos was standing there as the fury-crafted wave washed over his feet and rocked the Slive hard to its starboard side, and his eyes were wide with shock. The ship righted itself in the water, and Deimos stirred, turning back to his men and bellowing orders that could barely be heard over the bellows of angry leviathans. Asana turned to Araris at once, crouching over him and laying her hands on his abdomen. There was a gaping wound in his side, just below his lowest ribs. She grasped at the split flesh with her hands, pushing it back together, pressing her attention down through her fingers. The wound was massive and uncomplicated, but if the bleeding wasn't stopped and soon, he would not live.
"I did not go through that torture at Ceres to let you die now," she heard herself snarl.
Then she willed Ryl down into the wound, found its edges with the Fury's help, and began to bind them together, to contain the blood trying to rush from his body. It was difficult, and Asana felt her strength swiftly fading, but it had to be done. She did not relent in her efforts until she felt the artery mend, felt the pressures of his body begin to stabilize. After that she finally relented, slumping, gasping for breath, and weary in every fiber of her being. She looked up to find Tavi staring at her. She looked around. Kitai was watching her as well, her canted eyes brilliant in the lowering light. Eren's face was awed. Deimos, too, stood watching her, as did a dozen sailors.
"Bloody crows," one of the men said. "She didn't even use a tub."
Asana blinked and stared down at her bloodied hands, at the unconscious man beneath them.
She hadn't? She hadn't.
Bloody crows, indeed. That was impossible. Only the most powerful watercrafters in the realm could... There was another vast, sea-shaking bellow. Asana looked up, as did everyone else on the Slive, to see the first leviathan attack the Mactus. It rose from the sea, a mountain of armored flesh and frenzied rage. It lifted the Mactus from the waves, and the crack of timbers snapping as its keel shattered cut through the twilight. Men screamed, falling from the ruined ship, rendered into toys by the distance and by the sheer magnitude of scale. Some of them splashed into the ocean. Some fell upon the bulk of the leviathan, its hide no more forgiving than the rocks of a hostile shore. Half of the ship stayed afloat for a moment, but only until a second leviathan rammed the first, crushing it between them. Men thrashed desperately for life, insects among the angry titans of the sea. Some of them had managed to get a few of the small boats into the sea, but they could not long remain afloat in that maelstrom. And the growing darkness,
the surge of furious leviathans slamming into one another in their rage, and the tortured sea swallowed them as the Slive sailed on. Isana felt the horror in those around them, and the sympathy. She realized that these men, though pirates and scoundrels, though struggling to stay alive against a foe who would surely have killed them, had just witnessed one of their own nightmares. None of them desired to see another sailor die the way the men of the Mactus had. Isana shook her head, struggling to separate her senses from those around her. It was too much, and her head had begun to pound again.
"All right," growled a voice, whose tone brooked no dissent.
Her son, she thought dully.
"Show's over. Aaron, get the cabin door. Kitai."
Isana looked up dully as Kitai, still shirtless, calmly picked her up as she might carry a child. The Marat girl gave Isana a small, encouraging smile while Tavi picked up Araris.
"It was well done," Kitai murmured to Isana quietly. "We're back safe. Time to rest now."
Isana began to protest. She'd closed the worst of the wound, but Araris would need more attention, and she didn't even know if any of the others had been injured. She began to tell Kitai to put her down and fetch a healing tub. But somewhere between drawing a breath and using it to speak, she lost the will to keep going, and embraced the promise of silence and peace in her exhaustion. Chapter 27
"Bloody crows," snarled Antilla Maximus. "Right now the captain's taking it easy, sleeping in his bunk in a nice comfortable cell back at the fort at the Ellenarch while we're getting soaked to the skin."
Valiar Marcus stepped down from the block that let him peer over the first Ilaran's palisade and view the enemy position at the ford of the river Ipan. The Khanim had employed the talents of the Free Ilaran Legions. Their earthcrafters weren't the equals of a Legion engineering corps, and the positions they directed weren't made of the multi-layered stone of a battle-crafted siege wall. But the heavy earthworks they had raised on the far side of the shallow ford were massive enough to provide a formidable defensive position.
"Betty's eating hot breakfast cakes right now," Maximus continued.
The young tribune glowered up at the steady rain.
"Maybe a morning cup of tea. Probably borrowed one of Cyril's books. Cyril's the sort to have a lot of books."
Antillus Crassus stepped down from his own block and glowered at Max.
"I'm certain you never complained this much to Captain Scipio."
"Yes, he did,"
Marcus murmured.
"Just never in front of anyone. Except me."
Crassus gave Maximus a very direct look.
"Tribune, I hereby order you to stop whining."
"That never worked for Scipio," Marcus noted.
"It's a sacred right," Max said.
He chinned himself up on the palisade briefly, then dropped back down to the ground again.
"Looks like they're getting ready to change the guard."
"Signal the engineers," Crassus said.
Marcus turned and flashed a hand signal at the nearest Marat horseman, in this case horsewoman, he supposed. She nodded, turned, and galloped to the top of the low hill behind them, and repeated the gesture in broader strokes.
"It isn't going to buy us much time, hitting them during their shift change," Max said.
"It doesn't need to," Marcus replied. "They're expecting a shooting match. A few seconds will make the difference."
He turned and nodded to the file leaders of the Prime Cohort. They saluted, and murmured orders went down the ranks. The veterans drew their swords in slithering whispers of steel. Crassus turned and beckoned a runner. The young man hurried over.
"Please inform the Honorable Senator that our initial assault is about to begin."
The runner saluted and pelted away. Marcus stepped up onto the block again and watched the river. At first he couldn't see it happening. The change was too slight. His ears, though, picked up on a change in the constant, almost silent murmur of the water sliding between the banks. The pitch rose, and Marcus leaned forward, watching intently. The ford was about 3 feet deep under normal circumstances, slightly deeper given the steady rain they'd had during the past week. It was not too deep for infantry to ford, but it was more than deep and swift enough to take a man from his feet if he wasn't careful.
Trying to cross the ford in the face of the enemy's defences would be a slow and bloody business, where the Baylists and Bows of the combined Carnim and ex-slave forces would be able to take a terrible toll. It would be possible to grind resistance down eventually, but a conventional assault would require a hefty price in blood. Which was, Marcus reflected, probably why Arnos had given the first Aleran the dubious distinction of leading the attack. Marcus wasn't sure if the captain would have run the battle the same way, but he was certain that he would have approved of Crassus's immediate response to such a bloody scenario. To change the scenario.
"Sir," Marcus growled.
Crassus drew his blade and nodded to Maximus. The big Antillean gave his half-brother a grin, and with a murmur to the knight's Pisces drew his sword. They immediately readied their own weapons. Marcus kept his eyes on the river, struggling to see through the almost lightless evening and the steady rain. The reeds the scouts had placed earlier that day had been stripped to pure white wood that would be more easily seen in the dark. But even so, Marcus began to wonder whether or not it would do him any good. Then he saw a gleam of fresh white on the river. And a second. A moment later, a third.
"That's it,"
he hissed. "Three rods. The river is running less than a foot deep.
Now,"
Crassus snapped. Marcus jerked hard on the rope beside him, stepped down from the block, drew back his leg, and kicked at the palisade. Though it seemed a standard Legion defensive wall from the other side, the engineers had altered a 200-foot section of the fence, and when Marcus kicked down the section immediately in front of him, the others fell as well in a sudden wave, crashing to the earth on the far side. Cries went up in the other camp, but they were immediately drowned out as Crassus lifted his sword, let out a howling battle cry, and the knights and veterans around him responded in kind. Crassus dropped his blade forward, and the prime cohort and knights Pisces surged forward, with Marcus, Crassus, and Maximus in the first rank. The first Aleran hit the now shallow water of the ford and surged toward the opposite bank. Arrows began to fly from the earthworks. In the dark and confusion and splashing water, Marcus knew that only a very skilled or very lucky shot from any Aleran bow would have a chance of downing one of the heavily armored legionaries. Most arrows skimmed off of the steel helmets, or slammed harmlessly into the steel-lined wooden shields of the legion. Some didn't. Marcus heard a scream on his right, and felt more than saw the sudden drag in the integrity of the cohort's formation as someone else went down and slowed the advance of those behind him. An arrow struck sparks from Maximus's helmet, and another flickered past Marcus's ear with an eerie fluttering hiss. They were halfway across before the Carnim sharpshooters went to work. The flat, metallic twang of the odd bows was not loud, but they were near enough now to hear it. Each twang was followed almost instantly by the heavy sound of impact, a thud accompanied by the shriek of torn steel. Marcus saw from the corner of his eye as another file leader went down, as did the two men in tight formation behind him. Men screamed, and the advance grew more sluggish.
"Now, Max!" Crassus shouted.
The acting captain of the Legion lifted his blade, and it was suddenly wreathed in brilliant flame, a beacon and a signal to every man in the Legion, not to mention to everyone in the enemy lines as well. At the same time, Maximus stretched out a hand toward the waters remaining between the first Aleran and the shore. He cried out, and a sudden swirl of wind went rushing down the river, spinning and twisting into a miniature water spout that threw up great shimmering sheets of water, obscuring the flaming sword and its wielder from easy observation.
"Forward!" Crassus cried.
The fire on the blade pulsed and shimmered.
"Forward! For Alera!"
As he finished his cry, Crassus unleashed the firecrafting he'd been preparing. Rage poured through Marcus, more sudden, hotter, and more violent than any he had felt in years. Every other thought was scorched away by the fire of his anger, and he found himself letting out another cry of eagerness to meet the enemy in battle. The hesitation of the advancing force vanished entirely as nearly 800 throats erupted in a simultaneous bellow of raw hostility. The first Aleran picked up speed, building to a furious charge as they crossed Maximus's wind-crafted water screen. Driven by that anger, they thrust themselves into the teeth of the enemy, utterly ignoring the missiles that continued streaking toward them, claiming lives. The first Alaran took its hits as it emerged from the river and accepted them as a necessary price to come to grips with their foe. They surged up the earthworks, spearheaded by the first Alaran's Knight's Terror. They struck the mixed earth and stone defences with their great hammers, triggering a minor landslide, one that could be climbed up and over the defensive walls. Marcus, Maximus, and Crassus were the first to set foot on the improvised ramp, advancing up to the makeshift battlements. There, they met the enemy. Marcus had been ready to face the Carnum again, but the former slaves were another matter entirely. As he gained the wall, a boy of no more than 15 summers raised a bow, fumbling at an arrow. Marcus had no time to think. His arm lashed out, and the young soldier fell back, blood rushing from his open throat. Marcus stared at the boy for a shocked second, a single thundering heartbeat that suddenly stretched, elongated, drawing the rest of the world into a deceptively dreamy languor. The rage still burned in him, but for that instant it existed outside of himself, a part of the background that was neither more nor less important than the sounds of battle. The boy's neck was marred by collar scars. Old ones. If he truly had been 15 years of age, then he must have gained his scars when he was scarcely old enough to walk, and Marcus had few illusions about what sorts of uses a slaver would find for a helpless child. Arnas had named the Free Alarans traitors, but crows, Marcus wasn't sure that he would not have done precisely the same thing had he been in their place. The lot of a slave in the southern portions of the realm was a dismal one, and the tolerance of every man, citizen or not, had its limits. Then there was a furious lupine roar, and the frozen instant ended. Marcus ducked the swing of a curved Carnim sword and found himself facing 8 feet and several hundred pounds of furious steel-armored warrior-cast Carne. Marcus was a competent swordsman, and he knew that his own Earthcrafter's strength gave him significant advantages against most opponents. Against one of the Carnim of the warrior caste, though, he had no advantage of strength, and he might well be the Carne's inferior at blade work. He had not become an old soldier, though, by fighting for pride, and as the Carne advanced and swung again, Marcus shed the blow at an oblique angle along his lifted shield, shoved forward inside his opponent's guard, and drove his gladius into the Carne's knee. The Carne howled and lurched. Maximus had seen Marcus press in for the ugly little disabling attack, and before the Carne could recover and hew into Marcus, the young tribune's sword licked out and back in a single motion, and gore erupted from the Carne's throat. Marcus got his balance again and menaced a foe that was pressing an attack on Maximus's flank, and they drove forward into a half-panicked group of Free Alarans. Marcus was glad that they didn't put up too much of a fight. He slammed one man to the ground with his shield, dealt out a couple of non-lethal cuts with his blade, then the foe was running. Marcus pressed close behind them, down off the fortifications and onto the ground on the far side, and the men of the prime cohort pressed in with him. There they met a hastily assembled counter-attack from the Carnim. The wolf warriors had gathered 30 or 40 of their number. Shocking, really, given how little time they'd had to prepare, and indicative of considerable military discipline. And they charged the Alaran forces with blood-maddened howls. Marcus bellowed, "Shield high, blade low!"
"Shield high, blade low!"
the cohort roared back, quoting the doctrine that they'd devised as one of the only viable tactics against the immense foe. The Carnim hit the line, but their descending weapons were met by a raised curtain of legion shields, and the soldiers in the front row concentrated on nothing but dishing out disabling blows to the feet, knees, legs, and groins of their attackers. The Carnim had comparatively little experience in fighting a foe so much smaller than themselves, and the low-line attacks had repeatedly proved to be difficult for them to defend against. Carnim smashed at the legion's shield wall. One legionare's shield took a blow squarely, rather than at a proper angle for a deflection. Lined with steel or not, the shield splintered under the terrible force of the warrior Carne's blade, and the sword that had done it removed the legionare's arm at the shoulder. The man went down, screaming. Beside Marcus, Crassus caught the blow of an immense cudgel on his shield, and even with his fury-strengthened equipment and fury-assisted strength, he grunted with pain and faltered, his shield arm dropping limply to his side. Marcus cut across the young officer's front, deflecting the Carne's next blow, rather than attempting to match strength with strength, and thrust up at an angle into the Carne's lower abdomen. The Carne fell back with a howl of pain, and Marcus bellowed two of his veterans into position to shield Crassus. The press of combat abruptly loosened, relaxing, and Marcus realized that the prime cohort, followed closely by the rest of the first Alaran, had cleared the earthworks. Braying Carnim horns began to blow, and the enemy moved into a general retreat, falling back from their positions and vanishing into the rain and the dark. Crassus unstrapped his shield from his left arm, his face pale. Marcus turned and glanced at the young officer's arm.
"Shoulder's out of its socket," he said. "Need to get you to a healer, sir. Let them have the men who are bleeding first. I'm not feeling it right now, anyway."
He wiped his blade clean on the mantle of a fallen Carne, sheathed it, and looked around soberly.
"Have the engineers put the river back on its course and recall them. Deploy the 6th, 9th, and 10th cohorts to a perimeter. 2nd through 5th to erect a palisade. The rest in formation as a reserve."
Marcus saluted.
"Sir." "Wait," Maximus said.
He stepped closer to Crassus and lowered his voice.
"They're off balance, Crassus. We need to press the attack now while we have the advantage." "The objective was to take the ford," Crassus said. "We've done it."
"This is an opportunity," Max said. "We've got to press it. We might not get another chance like this to hit them when they aren't ready."
"I know," Crassus said. "It's almost too good to be true."
Marcus glanced up sharply at Crassus and frowned. Max scowled at Crassus.
"You're giving the Carnim too much credit this time." "Stop and think about this, Max," Crassus said. "It might hurt, but try to pretend you're a Carnim for a minute. When else are you going to get a chance to launch an attack against an Alaran legion isolated from the other two with it, on open ground, and in the dark, no less?"
Max glanced at Marcus.
"First spear, what do you think?"
Marcus grunted.
"This is a textbook target of opportunity, sir. If you don't order the pursuit after a rout like this, the Senator isn't going to like it."
"But do you think this is a trap?" Maximus pressed.
"It would take a bloody brilliant soldier to manage it," Marcus replied. "And Nasorg is," Crassus said.
He glanced at Maximus, then out at the dark, his brow furrowing in thought for a moment.
"You don't plan for what you think the enemy is going to do," he said finally. "You plan for what he is capable of doing. I'm not sending the Legion out there blind."
Maximus shook his head.
"I'm not eager to wrestle Carnim in the dark, but if you don't order an advance, Arnos is going to have your balls."
Crassus shrugged.
"Let him try to collect them, then. We secure the ford first. Get the men moving first, spear."
Marcus saluted Crassus and turned to the nearest runner, doling out a list of instructions.
"Meantime, send the Marat on ahead," Crassus said. "They can see in the dark and can outrun the Carnim. If they don't find the enemy in force out there, we'll send out the cavalry and keep the Carnim on the run." "I hope you know what you're doing," Max said. "If we stay put and I'm right, we save ourselves a lot of blood. If we stay put and I'm wrong, we've still taken this position and there are only two more between here and Mastings."
"Scipio would have advanced," Max said. "I'm sure of it."
Crassus rubbed at his injured shoulder, his expression undisturbed.
"I'm not Scipio," he said. "And you have your orders."
Maximus glowered at Crassus for a moment, then slammed his fist to his chest and went to his horse. He mounted, then let out an explosive sneeze. The tall Antillean scowled up at the falling rain and nudged his horse into motion, passing near Marcus.
"Lying in bed with a book," he growled to Marcus. "And with the ambassador, too, I'll wager."
Maximus nudged his horse into a trot, and a moment later, Half an ala of Marat cavalry thundered through the captured earthworks and into the country beyond. Marcus oversaw the positioning of the remainder of the legion, with some of the men in advance positions, others erecting the mobile palisade wall behind them, and the rest standing in ranks in the center of their position, ready to march or fight should the need arise. Once that was done, Marcus returned to find Crassus speaking to one of the senior officers of the First Senatorial Guard. The man was evidently angry, because he gestured extensively as he spoke. Crassus stared at the man with no expression on his face and spoke a single word in reply. The guard officer spat something in a harsh tone and strode away. Marcus approached Crassus calmly.
"Trouble, sir?"
Crassus shook his head.
"The senator's man. You were right."
The first spear nodded.
"Let's get you to the healers, sir."
"It can wait," Crassus said. "Apparently we've captured some more ballists, and I want to make sure they are properly secured before—"
"With respect," Marcus said. "No, sir, it can't wait. Just because you can't feel the pain doesn't mean you aren't doing more damage to your shoulder. We're going to the healers, sir, now."
Crassus arched an eyebrow in a gesture nearly identical to the captain's. Marcus supposed that he had learned it from Scipio. Then Crassus glanced down at his shoulder and gave Marcus a rueful smile.
"If I was anyone else, I'd be ordering me to go to the healers, wouldn't I?"
"Yes, sir,"
Marcus said. Crassus sighed, nodded, and the two of them turned to walk toward where Foss had set up his tents and healing tubs.
"Marcus," Crassus said quietly, "I haven't thanked you."
"For what, sir?"
"Your support. Your advice. I couldn't have taken over the Legion without your help."
"Comes with the job, sir," Marcus said.
Crassus shook his head.
"It doesn't. You're always the one willing to go one step farther. You're the first one up in the morning and the last one to sleep at night. You push us all to do better. You keep discipline among the men without resorting to intimidation or humiliation. If you hadn't already won an honor name in the House of the Valiant, your service over the last few years would merit a place in the House of the Faithful."
Marcus fell silent and glanced away from the young man. They had reached the healers' tents. Several wounded men lay on stretchers on the ground, bandaged while they waited their turns in the healing tubs. Several other men lay senseless on bedrolls nearby, fresh pink skin showing where their wounds had been watercrafted closed, exhausting them in the process. Lady Aquitaine, in her washerwoman guise, was there, serving as an attendant to the wounded, carrying them water and monitoring their injuries. She glanced up at Marcus, smiled very slightly, and returned to her tasks.
"Fidela, Marcus, just doesn't roll off the tongue as well, though, does it?"
Crassus continued.
"All the same, I thought you should know that I am aware of all the extra work you do. Thank you."
Marcus tried not to spit out the bitter taste in his mouth.
"You're welcome, sir."
Chapter 28 The rain, Amara decided, was a mixed blessing. While the moderate, steady downpour helped to hide their trail and cut down on visibility, reducing their chances of being seen, after 3 days it had begun to gall. Here at the southernmost reaches of the realm, rainfall such as this was not unusual this time of year, but Amara had never had to contend with such a relentless downpour. The nights were uncomfortable, especially because there was no dry wood to be had for a fire. Bernard told Amara that he could have used his crafting to shape the trees into a more effective shelter, or to open a dry hole in a rock shelf, but that he didn't dare risk it, for fear enemy woodsmen might recognize it. Despite that, Amara's husband was as resourceful as ever about practical matters. He always managed to find some means by which to keep at least some of the water away from them, but none of them were resting very well. If the rain didn't let up soon and allow them something other than a cold meal of travelling biscuits, they were going to run out of them and be forced to eat only whatever Bernard could forage or hunt as they travelled. Amara was not looking forward to raw rabbit. She glowered up at the sky and wished that she had more practice with crafting the weather instead of flying.
"I know precisely how you feel," Gaius murmured, limping steadily along. I can't stop thinking about how nice a warm fire and a hot cup of tea would be.
Amara smiled. Is it that obvious?
We're all thinking the same thing, Gaius replied.
He squinted up at the clouds.
This is mostly my fault, you know.
Amara glanced aside at him. Why do you say that?
Because it was my mistake. The wind that brought us here was from the far north, cold and dry. I bade it fly south with us, and it met the warm, humid skies over the sea. Rain is the result.
Amara shook her head. Not a terrible mistake. The rain has probably helped us a great deal. Gaius smiled, teeth gleaming.
Just between the two of us, I've had all the help I can stand.
Amara laughed, and her eye alighted upon the nearest tree trunk. Perhaps 7 feet up, the bark had been roughly gouged and scored to the inner skin, with thick, crude furrows. Bernard, Amara called quietly.
I saw them,
he said. What are they?
Territorial markings, Bernard replied.
Territorial markings? Of what?
A predator, Bernard said. Maybe some kind of hunting cat. Maybe one of those big lizards.
He stopped and held up a hand, his head tilted slightly to one side.
They're called Garim, Gaius supplied quietly. They make marvellous cloaks when...
The underbrush, 10 feet to the First Lord's left, erupted in sudden motion, and something massive and leathery and low shot across the forest floor, its head turning sideways, its jaws gaping to snap at Gaius's legs. It was an enormous lizard, a Garim. The First Lord saw it coming, and he reacted with admirable speed. He managed to turn and thrust his heavy walking staff into the beast's jaws. The Garim snapped them shut, neatly clipping off the end of the staff. Then it spat the wood aside and pressed in on Gaius. Gaius's maneuver, though, had given Amara precious seconds to act. The cursor called upon Cirrus, borrowing of the wind fury's swiftness, and the world slowed down to a lazy, syrup-thick dance. Amara's hand dipped to her belt, and her fingers found the hilt of the knife there. She drew, even as she turned toward the menacing Garim, shifting her weight with maddening slowness, and flung the knife at what, to her own perceptions, was almost normal speed. The knife tumbled precisely 1.5 times, struck the creature's scaled hide, and sank several inches into the Garim's flank, just behind its forward leg. The Garim reacted more slowly than any animal she had ever seen would have, and Amara had taken most of a step before it suddenly wrenched itself to one side, falling into a slow tumble as it snapped its jaws at the knife, tearing it free. Amara drew her sword and flung herself at the beast, gripping the short weapon in both hands. The extra speed lent her by her fury would allow her to deal out a powerful blow, and she would need it to cut through its hide, if the lack of penetration from her knife throw was any indication. The steps between her and the Garim drifted by slowly, and she had time to appreciate another mixed blessing. Though the gift of speed granted by her fury made her swift enough to intervene on the First Lord's behalf, it also left her with entirely too much time to realize the danger in her course of action. The beast was much larger than she had thought at first. Though it stood very low to the ground, no more than 2 feet at the highest point of its back, the Garim was built broad and flat, with powerful legs that spread out widely from an overly broad body made from gristle and sinew. It probably weighed at least twice what Amara did, and quite possibly more. Its feet were tipped with heavy claws, its head was solid and blocky, distended with the size of the muscles that powered its vicious jaws. It had eyes like beads of black glass, small and vicious and stupid, and its tail, stretching out in length nearly equal to its body, thrashed about with entirely too much power and speed. Its hide was dark grey-green, and rippled with stripes of darker coloration, giving it ideal camouflage in the rain-drenched forest, and the scales looked tough and thick. If the Garim seized her, It would remove her limbs every bit as easily as it had snapped through Gaius's walking staff. She could evade it easily, of course, if she had been on her own, but she wasn't. The creature had deliberately rushed Gaius, and if she did not force it to deal with her, it would only return to its attack on the First Lord. She had to fight, which meant that she had to deal out a decisive, crippling stroke on the first blow, or risk being overwhelmed by the beast's power and speed. She would have aimed for the throat, had this been a Thanodont or a grass lion or one of the Marat's herd banes. The Garim's neck, though, was covered in great folds of heavily scaled skin, and she doubted her ability to strike through it. Unlike the Garim, which could snap through her neck without any particular effort. Amara was terrified. The eyes, she decided. A small target, true, but Cirrus's speed would help with that. A true enough strike had the potential to kill the beast, and even if she only wounded it, that might disable the Garim badly enough to prevent it from pursuing Gaius. Though, if it came to that, she supposed, killing Amara, dragging her body off into the forest and devouring her might prevent the Garim from pursuing Gaius as well. Looking at it from that perspective, Amara thought, she couldn't lose. The Garim's broad, vicious head swiveled toward her, and its wide mouth opened, revealing what seemed like hundreds of curved, vicious teeth. Amara screamed and thrust the blade down, putting all the speed and power she could muster into the blow. The tip of her sword struck just above the Garim's beady eye, pierced a thin layer of skin, and scraped along the thick bone of its skull. Her forward momentum carried her on over the low-slung Garim, and she realized with a sick sensation of panic that she was about to fall. Amara tried to turn the fall into a diving roll so that she would be able to come up on her feet and running, but halfway through something struck her in the shoulder and sent her into an uncontrolled tumble. She hit the ground hard, first on one knee, then slammed into the ground with one shoulder, and fetched up against a tree with stunning force. She dropped to the ground, the world rolling back into normal motion again, as she lost concentration on maintaining the link with Cirrus. The wounded Garim lashed its heavily muscled tail, with which it had just struck her, and doubled back on itself with sinuous liquid speed. It rushed her, fangs bared. Amara fumbled dazedly for her sword, knowing even as she did that the weapon would be of little use. She thrust out as the Garim closed on her, and the sword skittered off the hide of its chest. She screamed. And then a length of wood came out of nowhere and landed with crushing force on the creature's muzzle, slamming its jaws closed and into the ground. Its head rebounded from the earth, and the wood landed again and again, the blows precisely timed and savage. The First Lord of Alera flung himself onto the Garim, slipping his damaged staff across the beast's throat, and with a snarl of effort and a wrench of his entire body, twisted away, taking the Garim with him, rolling the lizard belly up.
"His underside!" Gaius cried. "Countess, where the scales are thin!"
Amara seized her sword, lurched to her knees, and struck down through the Garim's exposed throat, just beneath where Gaius's staff still held back the creature's head. To her surprise, the sword swept cleanly through the finer, smoother scales there, and blood rushed out in a scarlet fountain. The Garim thrashed wildly, but the First Lord had the creature pinned. Though it flung him back and forth, it could not escape Gaius's hold. Amara struck again and again until the Garim's thrashing slowed, and the First Lord rolled clear of the dying animal.
"My lord,"
Amara gasped.
"I'm all right," Gaius panted. "The Count!"
Amara rose, looking around wildly, and realized that there was something else about the deadly lizards she had not known. They ran in packs. One Garim hung thrashing 15 feet above the forest floor in a willow tree, where dozens of the slender branches had seemingly reached down and wrapped around it. Another thrashed and contorted wildly on the forest floor, bounding up as high as 5 or 6 feet above the ground. A woodsman's axe protruded from the dying Garim's head, where a powerful blow had sunk the weapon to its eye in the lizard's skull. And the bloodied Count of Cauldron himself was locked in combat with a third Garim, unarmed. Like the First Lord, he had managed to gain a position on the beast's back, but he had locked his arms around the creature's throat. Amara could see that blood covered one side of his face, his throat, and half of his upper torso, but he was conscious, his face locked into a rictus snarl. The garem thrashed wildly, rolling over several times, and its tail whipped about with savage energy, hammering Bernard on his legs and lower back. He let out a howl of rage and pain. Amara cried out and rushed toward her husband, sword in hand.